I'm Jared, and you're listening to The Changelog, where each and every week we have conversations with the hackers, the leaders, and the innovators of the software world. We pick their brains, we learn from their mistakes, we get inspired by their accomplishments, and we have a lot of fun along the way. For the past year, David Crawshaw has intentionally sought ways to use LLMs while programming in order to learn about them. He now regularly uses LLMs while working and considers their benefits a net positive on his productivity. David wrote down his experience, which we found both practical and insightful. Hopefully you will too. But first, a quick mention of our partners at Fly.io, the public cloud built for developers who ship. Check them out at fly.io. Okay, David Crawshaw on the changelog. Let's do it.
Well, friends, before the show, I'm here with my good friend, David Hsu, over at Retool. Now, David, I've known about Retool for a very long time. You've been working with us for many, many years. And speaking of many, many years, Brex is one of your oldest customers. You've been in business almost 7 years. I think they've been a customer of yours for almost all those 7 years, to my knowledge. But share the story. What do you do for Brex? How does Brex leverage Retool? And why have they stayed with you all these years?
So what's really interesting about Brex is that they are an extremely operational heavy company. And so for them, the quality of the internal tools is so important because you can imagine they have to deal with fraud, they have to deal with underwriting, they have to deal with so many problems, basically. They have a giant team internally, basically just using internal tools day in and day out. And so they have a very high bar for internal tools. And when they first started, we were in the same YC batch, actually. We're both at Winter 17, and they were, I think maybe customer number 5 or something like that for us. I think DoorDash was a little bit before them, but they were pretty early. And the problem they had was they had so many internal tools they needed to go and build, but not enough time or engineers to go build all of them. And even if they did have the time or engineers, they wanted their engineers focused on building external facing software, because that is what would drive the business forward. Brex mobile app, for example, is awesome. The Brex website, for example, is awesome. The Brex expense flow, all really, really great external facing software. So they wanted their engineers focused on that as opposed to building internal CRUD UIs. And so that's why they came to us. And it was honestly a wonderful partnership. It has been for 7-8 years now. Today, I think Brex has probably around 1,000 Retool apps they use in production, I want to say every week, which is awesome. And their whole business effectively runs now on Retool. And we are so, so privileged to be a part of their journey. And to me, I think what's really cool about all this is that we've managed to allow them to move so fast. So whether it's launching new product lines, whether it's responding to customers faster, whatever it is, if they need an app for that, they can get an app for it in a day, which is a lot better than, in 6 months or a year, for example, or having to schlep through spreadsheets, et cetera. So I'm really, really proud of our partnership with Brex.
Okay, Retool is the best way to build, maintain, and deploy internal software, seamlessly connect to databases, build with elegant components, and customize with code, accelerate mundane tasks, and free up time for the work that really matters for you and your team. Learn more at retool.com. Start for free, book a demo. Again, retool.com.
We are here with David Crawshaw, CTO and co-founder of Tailscale. David, welcome to the changelog.
Yeah, I'm not actually the CTO anymore.
Oh, no, your LinkedIn is outdated.
Oh, does it still say that? I thought I had updated it. I'm sorry.
Are you masquerading, David?
That's real-time LinkedIn updates here.
It'll be enthralling. Yeah, let's do it. Jit LinkedIn updates.
Got it. I read it somewhere. I usually LinkedIn. Me too. Will snag before the show starts.
I think my LinkedIn, it might be confusing because it still lists that I was the CTO. I stepped back from the CTO last year.
Okay. So what are you doing now?
I am spending my time exploring sort of new product spaces, things that can be done. So both inside and outside of Tailscale. So
very cool.
Most of my work inside Tailscale is around helping on the sort of customer side, talking to users or potential users about how it can be useful. And then because I have such an interest in sort of the world of large language models. I've been exploring that, but that is not a particularly good fit for the Tailscale product. You know, I spent quite a long time looking for ways to use this technology inside Tailscale, and like, it doesn't really fit. I actually think that's a good thing. You know, it's really nice to find clear lines like that when you find something where it's not particularly useful. And I wouldn't want to try and, you know, a lot of companies are attempting to make things work, even if they don't quite make sense. And I think it's very sensible of Tailscale to not go in that direction.
Do you mean like deploying LLMs inside of the Tailscale product, or how do you mean it wouldn't fit?
Well, so what would Tailscale do with LLMs is the question I was asking from a Tailscale perspective. I think Tailscale is extremely useful for running LLMs yourself for a network backplane.
Right.
In particular, because of the sort of surprising nature of the network traffic associated with LLMs. On the inference side, so you can kind of think about working with models from both a training and an inference. These are sort of two sides of the coin here. And training is very, very data heavy and is usually done on, you know, extremely high bandwidth, low latency networks, InfiniBand style setups on clusters of machines in a single room. Or, you know, if they're spread beyond the room, you know, the next room is literally in the building next door. The inference side looks very different. There's very little network traffic involved in doing inference on models. And it, in terms of bandwidth, the layout of the network is surprisingly messy. This is because sort of the nature of finding GPUs is tricky even still today, despite the fact that this has been a thing for years now. If you have...
Very tricky.
Yeah, this is... I feel I should try and explain it just because it's always worth trying to explain things, but I'm sure you all know this, which is that if you're running a service on a cloud provider that you chose years ago for very good reasons, all the cloud providers are very good at fundamental services, but they all have some subset of GPUs and they have them available in some places and not others. And it's never quite what you're looking for. And if you are deciding to run your own model and do inference on it, you might find your GPU is in a region across the country, or it's on a cloud provider that's different than the one you're using, or your cloud provider can do it, but it's twice the price of another one you can get. And this leads to people ending up far more in sort of multi-cloud environments than they do in sort of traditional software. And so Tailscale actually is very useful there. So for users, I think it's, you know, it's a great fit. But what does the product actually need as like new features to support that? And the answer is, you know, it actually is really great as it is today for that.
There's no specific AI angle that you can add to the product and immediately make it more useful.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there are, we came up with some proposals, but they're not exciting. Like they would be very much, we'd be doing it because, you know, corporate in an, you know, at headquarters told us to find an angle for AI or something like that.
Sure.
And like, you know, we as a startup have the option of just not doing that. And so we didn't. So.
Well, we should probably disclaim that Tailscale is a past and, of course, hopefully a future sponsor of Changelog. And that Adam's a huge
Tailscale
user.
We're working on it.
And brings it up often, but this is not a sponsored episode. In fact, well, first of all, we don't do sponsored guest appearances, but also I had no idea that you were a co-founder of Tailscale when I read your blog post. That made me reach out to you. I found it out afterwards. I was like, oh, cool.
That's great. I didn't know we'd be talking about Tailscale at all when I came here today. So that, I mean, we're both basically on the same page.
Yeah, there we go.
I still work there. I'm just kidding.
real-time update. I did double-check LinkedIn. You are correct. It says 2019 to 2024 was CTO, but you just see co-founder Tailscale and then CTO next to it, and you move on. And that's probably what Adam and I both did.
Same.
We didn't exactly realize there's an end date on that particular role.
Yeah, the nomenclature or usage on the metadata usage on LinkedIn is their UI is like which date, which month did you begin, and it says present. So the assumption was there. I didn't read your byline on the job role.
Maybe what I'll do is I'll put something new above it, and that'll make it clearer.
Yeah,
I don't want to mislead anyone.
Yeah. So. Fair enough.
I also honestly don't check LinkedIn very often. It's not a big part of my life. And so it,
we usually check it right before a show to make sure we get someone's title right, which is why we're right. both eating crow right now for getting it wrong. But
well, to get back into the mood or the groove, whichever you want to call it.
Let's get into both.
Well, I'm a TailScale user, as you know. I just trimmed some machines because I've been doing some more home labbing. So I use TailScale really only in my home lab. And thank you so much for this free tier because I don't want to give you any money, honestly. I'm just kidding with you. I think you're amazing. But like, I gotta put 100 machines on my tailnet before I have to pay you any money. I got 18. There's no way I'm ever going to pay you money based on your tiers, not mine.
That's totally great.
Which
I'm
is
very happy about that.
That's by design. That's by design. And I think, you know, one, thank you, because it's let me be more network curious and more home lab curious. So you, as a corporation, TailScale have allowed me and enabled me and so many others to do just that. And that's so cool. And I think I applaud y'all for that choice by design.
Well, thank you. That's excellent.
That being said, I mean, at the same time, I got to dig, and it's not really a dig. It's just really TailScale's kind of boring in the fact that I don't have to do much to make it work. You know, I put it in, I TailScale up, and I'm done. Okay, you just work. I never have to worry about you working unless you're
not up. You want to crash some more, or what are you looking for?
I'm just saying, like, it's pretty boring. You know, unless I'm doing like serves or I'm sharing a disk across the network, I'm not doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, this whole multi-cloud shared GPU thing is super cool because you can have a tailnet on top of a different network and share that GPU access, which I'm assuming is what you meant by that.
That's what I meant.
Just so cool. Honestly, it is.
I mean, I love boring software. And I so to me, the fact that you're having a boring experience is perfect.
Like yeah, man. No surprises.
Yeah.
No surprises.
It's a product that's designed to enable you to do more things, not for you to spend your days having to configure it.
It is so smooth. The DevX experience on this thing is bar none. You know, I know my machines. I know where they're at. I know if they're out of date. It's pretty easy to do that kind of stuff. And as an avid user and a lover of TailScale, again, not sponsored, just super passionate, I can't see how an LLM would fit in the other. I just can't see how you would work in AI to make the platform better. I mean, I haven't thought about it deeply besides this 20-ish minutes so far in the conversation, but I mean, give me some time and I might.
Yeah, if you come up with anything, let me know. I'm very excited about the idea of it, but software has to be, in some sense, true to itself. You have to think about its purpose when you're working on it and not step too far outside that. So I similarly wouldn't build a computer game in a TailScale. I don't think that would be a particularly, you know, good fit for a product.
And it's
As an Easter egg, it would be great, actually. Yeah. Like a little quiz game or something built into the terminal.
Once you have 100 machines in your tailnet, you get access to, you unlock a secret machine name there that's on your tailnet by default.
Part of the pro plan. Yeah.
There you go.
Right. It can ask questions like, what is the oldest machine on your tailnet or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that would be a lot of fun, actually.
There are some questions I would probably ask the tailnet. Like, there are actually some things I don't know about my tailnet that I could discover via a chat LLM interface. So, I mean, there are some things I can see some value in. But, I mean, does everybody want that or need that? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I very much went looking for something I would use features like that for, and I didn't come up with anything. If you do come up with anything again, I'd be very happy to hear about
honestly,
it.
Honestly, now that I'm thinking about it in real time, you know, you have a column whenever you're on your admin and you're on your machine's dashboard, essentially, you can see last seen or ones that are out of date. And unless you're savvy, you probably haven't enabled TailScale's ability to auto update. Maybe you haven't. I forget which machines I've done it on. Like everyone I install again, once I knew that update was there, I do enable that, but sometimes I forget. So I might be like, okay, are there any of my machines that haven't been seen in a while? Or are there any versions that are out? Give me a list of the ones that are out of date that I should probably concern with around security. Because you're probably not emailing me about my security concerns, but my tailnet knows which ones are too far out of date if I haven't auto-updated.
That's true. I think we did actually email customers once about an out-of-date version where we were concerned about the security. I think that has only come up once. Mostly, keeping TailScale up to date is sort of proactive, good security practice. It has fortunately not been a significant source of issues in part, you know, due to careful design. You know, a lot of engineers work very hard to make it that way.
For sure. You got a lot of amazing engineers there.
Yeah, it's a great team.
I guess now that I'm thinking about it, I do have some ideas.
Nice.
Well, I mean, I think this is the idea I have for Notion as well. I use Notion a lot, a lot more. Anything where you have a platform where you can create your own things on top of it, a telnet. You know, one telnet is not the same as the next, even though they operate the same. The way I use mine may not be the way you use yours. It would be nice to have an interface where I can just ask Tailscale how to Tailscale, basically. Like, I have an idea. I want to create a new group or a whatever, where I can be introduced to new features. It's discovery. And you're essentially, by not having your own, you force people to go into the, you know, public LLMs, essentially, into the ChatGPTs, into the Claudes, into the Olamas, into the DeepSeeks or whatever you might have out there. And if you can corner the market and own your own, I think you'd be, one, better served because you know your documentation better. Two, you know it's the deterministic nature of it is maybe non-deterministic, but you can probably fine-tune it a bit more to be more focused on your customer base. I'd probably ask my Tailscale LLM more questions if I could.
Yeah, so there's like an interesting sort of meta question there about LLMs around how many models there should be in the world from a sort of a consumer perspective, in a sense, because that's almost like, you know, you're just, you know, consuming it. Like, where, and this sounds very similar to like the question of how does search work on websites, which you could have asked 10 years ago or 20 years ago. You know, do I use the Wikipedia search or do I go to Google and type in my search and maybe put the word wiki at the end to bring the Wikipedia links to the top? Both of these are, you know, valid strategies for searching Wikipedia. And, you know, I honestly don't use the Wikipedia search and haven't in a while, so it may be amazing. But I have, as a consumer, a general concept that the search systems on individual websites are not terrific. And Google is baseline decent. And so as long as I'm searching public data, I would generally prefer the Google search. I guess in a sense, that's a less and less true statement every year because the large chunks of websites are just not public data anymore. Like, you can't search Facebook with Google.
Right.
You can't search Instagram with it. You can't find a TikTok with it or anything like that. And so the existence of those, I think they sometimes get called walled gardens, says that we should have more fine-tuned tools like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's just a lot of similarities there. So should a startup the size of Tailscale build customized models for that, for its users? I think is a sort of a big open-ended question around how the model space will evolve. And I think, you know, my last year of working with models, fine-tuning them, training them, carefully prompting them, you can do more and more just with carefully structured prompts and long contexts that you used to have to use fine-tuning to achieve. But all of this, my sort of big takeaway is that they are actually extremely hard to turn into products and to get those details right in a general sense for shipping to users. They're actually quite easy to get going for yourself. And I think, if anything, more people should, you know, explore running models locally and playing with them, because they're a ton of fun and they can be very productive very quickly. But in much the same way that it's really easy to write a Python script that you run yourself on your desktop versus a Python script you ship in production for users, LLMs have this huge sort of complexity gap when it comes to trying to build products for others. And so I agree that that sort of tooling would be fun and should exist. I also think where we are today, it's quite hard for a team the size of a startup to ship that as not part of their the core product experience.
What if it enabled so much deeper and greater usage? Because like, the one thing you want to do as a startup or a brand like you are, I would imagine, at least from the outside, is a deeper customer is better than a shallow customer. Right. If I've only got a few machines, well, one, my affinity and my usage is lower, so maybe my value is lower. But if I'm deeply entrenched and it's as a result of great documentation, which you have, but docs, they are good when you have a particular precision thing and you want to read and understand and discover how a feature works, and they only go so far and sometimes are even out of date. Just hypothesizing that whether or not like this, what would be required, one, in terms of a lift, one in engineering power, and two, potentially financial power. And then two, what is that costing you by lack of more deep users and, you know, shallow users in comparison?
I think that is exactly the right way to frame the question for a business. And I don't know the answer to a lot of those questions. I can talk to some of the more technical costs involved. What the benefits would be to the company is extremely open-ended to me. Like I can't imagine a way to measure that. Based on talking to customers of TailScale who deploy it, you know, thinking about the companies where, and so to go back to something you said earlier about how you use it and you don't pay for it, I think that's great because TailScale has no intention of making money off individual users. That's not a major source of revenue for the company. The company's major source of revenue is corporate deployments. And there's a blog post by my co-founder Avery about how the free plan stays free on our website, which sort of explains this, that individual users help bring TailScale to companies who use it for business purposes, and they fund the company's existence. So looking at those business deployments, you do see TailScale gets rolled out initially at companies for some tiny subset of the things it could be used for. And it often takes quite a while to roll out for more. And even if the company has a really good roadmap and a really good understanding of all of the ways they could use it, it can take a very long time to solve all of their problems with it. And that's assuming they have a really good understanding of all of the things it can do. And the point you're making, Adam, that people often don't even realize all the great things you can do with it is true. And I'm sure a tool that helped people explore what they could do would have some, you know, effect on revenue. In terms of the sort of the technical side of it and the challenges, one of the, you know, there's several challenges. In the very broad sense, the biggest challenge with LLMs is just the enormous amount of what you might call traditional non-model engineering has to happen out the front of them to make them work well. It's surprisingly involved. I can talk to some things I've been working on over the last year to give you a sense of that. Beyond that, the second sort of big technical challenge is one of sort of TailScale's core design principles is all of the networking is end-to-end encrypted. And the main thing an LLM needs to give you insight is a source of data. And the major source of data would be what is happening on your network, what talks to what, how does it all work? And that means that any model telling you how you could change your networking layout or give you insight into what you could do would need access to data that we as a company don't have and don't want. Mm-hmm. And so we're back to, it would have to be a product you run locally and have complete control over, which is absolutely, you know, the sorts, you know, my favorite sorts of products are that, you know, I like open source software that I can see the source code for, compile myself, run locally. That's how I like all things to be. But trying to get there with LLMs in the state they are today is actually, I think, pretty tricky. I don't think I've seen an actually shipped product that does that really well for people. There's a developer tool that I hear a lot of good talk about that I'm just trying to live search for it for you. Nope, that's the wrong one. That's Magic Shell History, which also sounds really cool. I should use that one.
Is that A2N?
A2N, yeah.
That one's awesome.
Oh, you've used it? Oh, great.
I'm a daily user. Yeah. No LLMs involved on that one.
Yeah, I thought that was the LLM. There's another one that is in the sort of agent space for developers as they're writing programs, and it helps you. It's like a local Claude, effectively. Okay. And it's primarily built around helping you construct prompts really carefully for existing open models. It's come up several times, and I'm sorry, it's fallen out of my head. I will look it up later.
It's all right.
But I hear very positive things about it. And that's the closest I've seen to sort of a shipped, completely local product that does that sort of thing. On which models to use, I think given the state of models that exist today, open models, the major shipped open models are so amazing that it always makes sense to start with one of those sort of models as a, if nothing else, as a pre-trained base for anything that's happening. Mm-hmm. Building a model from scratch is a very significant undertaking. And I don't think is necessary for most tasks. The available open models are extremely general purpose. And so at worst, you would be fine-tuning from one of those to build a product. You know, if you take one of the llamas or... I mean, there's a lot of talk about DeepSeek, which produces terrific results. It's a very large model. It'd be very hard to start with it, though I understand there's some very good distilled work coming from it using other models.
Well, friends, I am here with a new friend of mine, Scott Dietzen, CEO of Augment Code. I'm excited about this. Augment taps into your team's collective knowledge, your code base, your documentation, your dependencies. It is the most context-aware developer AI, so you won't just code faster, you also build smarter. It's an ask me anything for your code. It's your deep thinking buddy. It's your stand flow antidote. Okay, Scott, so for the foreseeable future, AI assisted is here to stay. It's just a matter of getting the AI to be a better assistant. And in particular, I want help on the thinking part, not necessarily the coding part. Can you speak to the thinking problem versus the coding problem and the potential false dichotomy there?
A couple of different points to make. You know, AIs have gotten good at making incremental changes, at least when they understand customer software. So first, and the biggest limitation that these AIs have today, they really don't understand anything about your code base. If you take GitHub Copilot, for example, it's like a fresh college graduate, understands some programming languages and algorithms, but doesn't understand what you're trying to do. And as a result of that, something like 2/3 of the community on average drops off of the product, especially the expert developers. Augment is different. We use retrieval augmented generation to deeply mine the knowledge that's inherent inside your code base. So we are a copilot that is an expert and that can help you navigate the code base, help you find issues and fix them and resolve them over time much more quickly than you can trying to tutor up a novice on your software.
So you're often compared to GitHub Copilot. I gotta imagine that you have a hot take. What's your hot take on GitHub Copilot?
I think it was a great 1.0 product, and I think they've done a huge service in promoting AI, but I think the game has changed. We have moved from AIs that are new college graduates to, in effect, AIs that are now among the best developers in your code base. And that difference is a profound one for software engineering in particular. You know, if you're writing a new application from scratch, you want a web page that'll play tic-tac-toe, piece of cake to crank that out. But if you're looking at, you know, a tens of millions of line code base, like many of our customers, Lemonade is one of them. I mean, 10 million line mono repo, as they move engineers inside and around that code base and hire new engineers, just the workload on senior developers to mentor people into areas of the code base they're not familiar with is hugely painful. An AI that knows the answer and is available 7x24, you don't have to interrupt anybody and can help coach you through whatever you're trying to work on, is hugely empowering to an engineer working in unfamiliar code.
Very cool. Well, friends, Augment Code is developer AI that uses deep understanding of your large code base and how you build software to deliver personalized code suggestions and insights. A good next step is to go to augmentcode.com. That's AugmentCode.com. Request a free trial, contact sales, or if you're an open source project, Augment is free to you to use. Learn more at augmentcode.com. That's AugmentCode.com. Augmentcode.com.
So you've been using these in your day-to-day programming work for the last year. And back in early January, you wrote this post, How I Program with LLMs, which I found to be refreshingly practical and straightforward, your findings. You said you've been actively trying these things. I feel like I've been passively trying them, not really trying to optimize my setup, but just like, you know, like a Neanderthal kind of poking at a computer box, you know, like, oh, does this work? No, okay, for the last couple of years. So I do use these things, but I don't think as effectively as most, or at least some. And I loved your findings, and of course you're building something as a result of it, but can you take us on that journey over the last year or so, where you started with LLMs and what you found in your day-to-day programming.
Yeah, I don't think your experience is unusual, actually. I think almost everyone has your experience. And for most software, I am in the same category. I try things at a very surface level when they're newish and see if there's any really obvious way they help me. And if they don't, I put them aside and come back later. Great example of that is the Git version control system. It was 10 years before I really sat down and used it. I was using other version control systems. After 10 years, I was like, okay, this thing's probably going to stick around. I guess I'll get over its user interface.
Fine.
Figure it out. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was reluctant, but you know, I got there in the end. LLMs really struck me as fascinating. I decided to, you know, I made this active decision to not do that with them and like set out on a process of trying to actively use them, which has involved learning just a, you know, a really appalling amount, honestly. Like, it's very reasonable that most engineers haven't done really significant things with LLMs yet because it's too much cognitive load. Like, you know, if you're writing computer programs, you're trying to solve a problem.
Right.
You only have so much of your brain available for the tools you use for solving problems because you have to fit the problem in there as well and the solution you're building. And that should be most of what you're thinking about. The tools should take up as little space as possible. And right now, to use LLMs effectively, you need to know too much about them. And you know, that is my sort of big, that was my big takeaway, you know, 11 months ago or so, which is why I started, you know, working on tools with some friends like, to try and figure this out. Because there has to be a way to make this easier. And my main conclusion from all of that is there's an enormous amount of traditional engineering to do in front of LLMs to get there. So the first really effective thing I saw from LLMs is the same thing I think most engineers saw, which was GitHub Copilot, which is a code completion. Oh, so actually, GitHub Copilot has taken on new meanings.
It's more than that now, right?
Yeah, it's an umbrella brand that means all sorts of products. And I actually honestly haven't even used most of those products at this point. The original product is a code completion system built into Visual Studio Code, where as you type, it suggests a completion for the line or a few lines beyond that of where you are, which is building on a very well-established paradigm for programming editors. You know, Visual Studio 6.0 did this 25 years ago with IntelliSense for completing methods in C++. This is not a new idea. And you know, around the same time we had e-tags for Emacs, or c-tags, I should say, which gave us similar things in the Unix world. And so this is sort of extending that idea by bringing out some of the knowledge of a large language model in the process of completing. And I'm really enamored with the entire model. Like, you know, Copilot's original experience when it came out was magical. Like, it was just like, there was nothing like this before.
It was.
And it really, I think, jump-started a lot of interest in the space from people who hadn't been working in it, which was almost all of us. And from my perspective, the thing that really struck me was, wow, this works really well. And wow, it makes really obvious, silly mistakes. There's both sides of this. It would suggest things that just don't compile in ways that are really obvious to anyone who takes a moment to read it. And it would also make, you know, really impressive cognitive leaps where it would suggest things that, yes, that is the direction I was heading. And like, it would have taken me several minutes to explain it to someone and it got there immediately. And so I spent quite a lot of time working on code completion systems with the goal of improving them by focusing on a particular programming language. And we've made some good some good progress there. We actually hope to demonstrate some of that publicly soon, like in the next few weeks, probably in this sketch.dev thing that we've been building. We'll integrate it so that people can see it and give it a try. But so those models are interesting because they're not the LLM experience that most users have. Like, when everyone talks about AI today, they talk about ChatGPT or Claude or these chat-based systems. And the thing I really, really like about the original Copilot code completion model is it's not a chat system. It's a different user interface experience for the knowledge in an LLM. And that's, you know, really a lot of fun. And in fact, the technology is a little bit different too. There's a concept in the model space called fill in the middle, where a model is taught a few extra tokens that don't exist in a standard chat model. With fill in the middle, which is a lot of fun, a model is taught a few extra tokens. And the it's taught a prefix token, a suffix token, and a middle token. And what you do is you feed in as a prompt to the model the file you're in. And everything, all the characters before where the cursor is, get fed right after a prefix token. So you feed in prefix, all the characters of the file. Then you feed in a suffix, and you feed in all the tokens after the cursor. And then you feed in the middle token, and then you feed in whatever goes into the middle to complete it. And that's the prompt structure for one of these models. And then the model keeps completing the thing that you fed in. It writes the next characters. And you train the model by taking existing code out there. There's a few papers on how these models are trained, because Meta published one of these models, and Google published one of these models under the Gemma brand. There's a few others out there. There's one from Quinn and some other derived ones. You take existing code files, you choose some section of code, you mark everything before it as the prefix, everything after it as the suffix, and you fill in everything after it as the middle. And that's your training data. You generate a lot of that by taking existing code and breaking it up into these files randomly, by randomly inserting a cursor. Then you've taught a model how to use these extra characters and how to complete them. And so it's not a chat model at all. It's a sort of a sequence to sequence model. It's a ton of fun. And the advantage of these systems is they're very fast compared to chat models. And that's the key to the whole code completion product experience, is you want your code completion within a couple hundred milliseconds of you typing a character. Whereas if you actually time Claude, or you time one of the OpenAI models, they're very slow. Like, they take a good minute to give you a result. And there's a lot of UI tricks in hiding that minute. They move the text around on the screen, then they stream it in.
Right.
It's just very clever.
Because you're reading it word by word as it comes out, but it's basically stalling. You're like, come on, just give me the answer already.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly. You can really feel it with the new reasoning models, O1, and these things, because there's this pause at the beginning. It hurts. The
thinking phase. I'm like, come on. And it tells you what it's thinking, which is cool, but it's like,
think faster.
I don't care what you're thinking. Give me the answer.
I think it's actually kind of cool when you see that reasoning come up. I mean, you get to see, like, I feel like this is the closest we've glimpsed into the future than we've ever been able to, by watching the reasoning in real time. You see the act of reasoning that it's happening. It explains the reasoning. Users ask me this, so I'm going to think about that. Okay, I've thought about that, which causes this. And it's like this step process, and it reminds me of how I think too. So I'm like, that's pretty dang cool. But it's also a great trick. I agree.
Yeah, it is a ton of fun to watch. I agree. And it is a lot of insight into how the models work too. Mm-hmm. Because the insides of the models are a large number of floating point numbers holding intermediate state. And it's very hard to get insight into those. But the words, you can read them. You can make some sense of them.
Right.
So code completion is, I think, extremely useful to programmers. It varies a lot depending on what you're writing and how experienced models are with it, and just how sort of out on the edge of programming you are. If you're really out in the weeds, the models can get less useful. I used a model for writing a big chunk of AVX assembly a few months ago, and the model was both very good at it and very bad at it simultaneously, and it was very different from the typical asking a model to help with programming experience. It would constantly get the order of operations wrong, or overcomplicate things, or misunderstand. It's a very different experience than typical programming.
What model was this? How did you find it?
I used all of them for that.
Okay.
And this is what I meant by I'm spending a lot of time actively exploring the space.
Yeah.
I'm putting far too much work into exploring the model space as I do work.
It makes sense that there are specific models that are good for autocomplete versus search versus chat, but have you found the correct one for each particular subtask, or what's your advice there? Is it like, use them all, or just stick with this, you'll be good?
I can't advise people to use them all. You know, it's too much
use
work.
A bunch of them.
Yeah. And this, I think, is the big problem. And you mentioned that most programmers are probably using this. As far as we can tell, not one fifth of programmers are using these tools today.
How can you tell that?
Through surveys. A couple of people have done surveys of programmers, and it seems to come back that most people are not using these tools yet.
Wow.
Which is both shocking to me because they're so useful, and also makes a lot of sense because it's a lot of work figuring out how to use them.
I have an analogy that I'd like to share. If you're a runner, you probably wear running shoes, right? You're probably not going to run barefoot. I think it's like admitting to running barefoot. Like, you wouldn't do that. You would run a marathon with rocks on the road and debris and things like that barefoot versus running shoes designed to aid you in the process of running to make it more speedy, comfortable, agile, etc. I feel like that's where we're at. Like, I've changed my tune, let's just say, because I feel like it's not going to go away. And to hear that one fifth, I haven't dug into these surveys, but that's surprising. One fifth is using it, and it seems like, I guess, then the four of the five are saying no, or for the time, for the moment, denying it. I mean, do either of you disagree with that analogy? Is it way off, or is it, Jared? I saw you kind of like shake your head a little bit. What's your thoughts on that? Now,
I mean, I don't think that these tools have come to the place that the running shoe has. I also think there's probably plenty of world-class runners who run shoeless and would never run with a shoe on, because that's for fools. But I'm not going to go there.
Well, would you run a New York City marathon with no shoes?
I wouldn't be so foolish as to try a New York City marathon.
Okay. You have to admit, though, that having the shoes on is probably better for you than worse for you.
Well, at what point has the shoe proven itself to be useless? Because these tools routinely prove themselves to not just be wrong, but dramatically wrong in ways that if you follow them, you will be like Michael Scott, who drives directly into the pond.
No, look, it means go up to the right, bear right over the bridge and hook up with 307.
Make a right.
Maybe it's a shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's a lake there.
I think it knows where it is going.
This is the
lake. Machine knows.
This is the lake.
Stop yelling at me.
No, it's not yelling.
There's no lake
here.
Oh, yes.
Because his voice assistant or
turn
his
left.
GPS tells him to keep going straight. And he just
I concur on that
straight.
One, too. I concur.
I can see why you could get frustrated and throw up your hands and say, I'm going to come back to this in a year or 2 years. But I'm going to let all the Frontiers people, like David, figure all this stuff out. In the meantime, I got code to write. I can see a lot of people saying that. I could see myself saying that. I haven't, because I am curious and I don't want to fall behind. But I'm still don't feel like this is a must have for everybody today. But there are moments where I'm like, that was amazing. So
for sure. I'm actively trying to fit it in into everything I do, is I guess my perspective. I'm actively, if it's home lab, it's that. If it's contracts, agreements, proposals, if it's thinking, if it's exploration, if it's coding, if it's you pick it's your if it's kind of thing. I'm trying to fit it in, and I'm sitting down on my bench. I got my socks on and I'm trying to put the shoe on, let's just say, you know, to kind of extend my analogy.
You're going
to
wear it.
Yeah. I believe that, you know, I'm going to put this shoe on. I'm going to wear it for every scenario that makes sense, because I can tell you I move faster. I think differently when I'm in those modes. Are they wrong? Do I always check it? Of course. But I know that it's coming for almost everything we do. Every task we do that's productive, coding, thinking, writing, whatever, it's coming for it in a positive way.
I mean, I totally agree that it is coming for it. I also think it's very early days, and a great reason to not learn this technology today is that it's changing so fast.
Yeah.
And that you can spend a very long time figuring out how to make it work, and then that can all of that accumulated skill can be sort of made useless tomorrow,
right,
by some new product.
Well, if you remember, Stable Diffusion first dropped probably 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were enamored with prompt engineering. And what was that artist name that you'd always, if you added it to your Stable Diffusion prompt, it would automatically get awesome. And then he got mad because everyone's using him to like make better pictures. Like that whole technology, you know, that magical incantation is just completely moot at this point. Like it's easier now to get better pictures without being such a wizard. And whatever name you were invoking in the past is just, that name doesn't do what it did on the last version of Stable Diffusion. Just as one instance, like prompt engineering has changed dramatically. And anybody who's ignoring it all and just listening to us talk about on the changelog and just like staying with their regular life, like they've saved themselves a lot of time than those of us who dove in and decided they were going to memorize all the magic words.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a year ago, a common technique with open models that existed was to offer them money to solve problems. You start every prompt by saying, I'll give you $200 if you do this.
Right.
And it greatly improved outcomes.
Yeah, or let's take this step by step. Like that phrase was one of those magical things that made it better.
It's like, all of those techniques are gone now. Yeah. Like if you try bribing a model, it doesn't help. There was a great example I saw of that where someone would kept saying, I'll give you $200 if you do this. And they did it in a single prompt several times.
Yeah.
And they got to the nth case and it said, but you haven't paid me for the previous ones yet. It
turned into a listen, fella, we had a deal.
No means that's no.
That's great.
No money means no. Yeah, there you go. All right.
Yes, they're very funny models. So I spent a long time believing, and I still believe this in the long term, that chat is currently our primary user interface on the models, and it's not the best interface for most things. The way to get the most value out of models today when you program is to have conversations with models about what you're writing. And that's, I think it's quite the mode shift to do that. It's quite taxing to do that. And it feels like a user interface problem that hasn't been solved yet. And so I've been working a lot with Josh Bleacher Snyder on these things. And we have been we spent a long time looking for how can we avoid the chat paradigm and make use of models. And that's why code completion initially was so interesting, because it's an example of using models without chat, and it's very effective. So we spent a long time exploring this. To give you another example of something we built in this space, because we've just been trying to build things to see what's actually useful. We built something called MERD.ai, which I think we put up a few weeks ago, and it does merge commits for you. So if you have if you try and push a git commit or do a rebase and you get a merge conflict, you can actually use LLMs to generate sophisticated merge commits for you. It turns out that's a much harder problem than it looks. Like you would think you just paste in all of the files to the prompt and you ask it to generate the correct files for you. Even the frontier models are all really bad at this. You almost never get a good merge commit out of them. But with a whole stack of really mundane engineering out the front, mundane's not the right word, because a lot of it's actually really very sophisticated. But it doesn't involve the LLM itself. It's about carefully constructing the prompt. Traditional is a much better word. Yeah. It's you can actually get very good merge commits out of it. And that user experience seems much better for programmers to me, that you could imagine that being integrated into your workflows to the point where you send a PR, there's a merge conflict, it proposes a fix right on the PR for you. And in fact, we attempted a version of that where there's a little Git bot that you can at mention on a PR, and it sort of generates another PR based on it that fixes the merge conflict for you. And that sort of experience doesn't require the chat interface to be exposed to the programmer to make use of the intelligence in the model. And that is where I dream of developer tools getting, so that everyone can use them without having to learn a lot about them. Like you shouldn't have to learn all the tricks for convincing a model to write a merge commit for you. There should be a button, or not even a button. It should just do it when GitHub says there's a merge conflict. And so it works pretty well. We've seen it generate some very sophisticated merge commits for us. I'd love to see more people give it a try and let us know what the state of that is. But so just because that is such a hard state to get to, we built Sketch, which exposes the traditional chat interface in the process of writing code, because we're just not... We don't think the models are at a point yet where we can completely get away from chat being part of the developer's workflow.
So at what level of granularity is Sketch working at? And do you imagine it moving up eventually, wherever it is? Because the panacea, right, the silver bullet, is what some folks are trying to do with Devin, for instance, where it's like, You describe at a very high level a system, and it goes and builds that system. V0 from Vercel is another one that's doing these things. And they're very much at, in my opinion, the prototype slash demo level of quality, not the production level of quality in their output. And it seems like they're very difficult. In my limited experience with these things, they're very difficult to actually mold, or what do you do? I'm losing a word here. Sculpt. I don't know, like a sculpture. To actually like sculpt what they come out with and change it into something that you actually would write or like. But those are like the very high level of like, well, it should have a contact form that submits to this thing. But maybe you're looking down more where I use them currently, which is like, yo, write me a function that does this particular thing, you know? And at that level, it seems a lot easier to even chat to if I have to. I would rather not chat to it, but spit out code that I could copy, paste, and modify versus being like, I'm going to throw this away and rewrite it.
Right. Yes. I think that lines up really well with the way Josh and I think about these things, where today, if you open up a model, a cloud provider's frontier model, or you know, a local DeepSeek or even a Llama 70B, you can ask it to write a Python script that does something. It could be a Python script to go to the GitHub API and grab some data and present it neatly for you. And it will do a great job. These great models can basically do this in a single shot, where you write a sentence and out comes a Python script that solves a problem. And like that's an astonishing technical achievement. It's amazing how quickly I've got used to that as a thing. But
yeah, you're not even impressing me right now. You know?
I know.
Like, yes, it can do that. We all exactly. know. But it is amazing.
Exactly. Like five years ago, if you told me that, I would struggle to believe it. And yet now I just take it for granted.
Yes.
And so that works. We've got that. We've got a thing that can write really basic Python scripts for us. Similarly, these systems, at least the frontier models, are good at writing a small React component for you. You can give almost any of them like you need more than a single sentence. You need just a few sentences to structure the React component, but out comes some HTML and some JavaScript in the React syntax, the JSX syntax or the TSX syntax. And it's pretty close. You know, it might need some tweaking. You might have some back and forth to get there, but you can get about that out of it. And clearly models are going to improve. There's no evidence to suggest we're at the limit here as the models keep improving every month at this rate. And part of what we're interested in Sketch is getting beyond helping you write a function, which I also use today, right? I get for frontier models to write functions for me. Mm-hmm. To sort of how can we sort of climb the complexity ladder there? And so the point we chose is a point that, you know, is comfortable for us and what is helpful for us is the Go package. How can we get a model to help us build a Go package to solve a problem? And there's a sort of an implicit assumption here in that the shape of Go packages looks slightly different at the end of this. Packages are a little bit smaller and you have a few more of them than you would in a sort of traditional Go program you wrote by hand. But I don't think that is necessarily a bad thing. Honestly, in my own programming, as a Go programmer, I tend to write larger packages because there's a lot of extra work involved in me breaking it into smaller packages. Mm-hmm. And there's often this thought process going on in my mind of like, oh, in the future, this would be more maintainable as more packages, but it's more work for me to get there today. So I'll combine it all now and maybe refactor it another day. And switching to trying to have LLMs write significant chunks of packages for you makes you do that work upfront. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's perhaps more the way we'd like our code to end up. And so Sketch is about taking an LLM and plugging a lot of the tooling for Go into the process of using the LLM to help it. So as you know, an example is I asked it the other day to write some middleware to broadly compress HTTP responses under certain circumstances because Chrome can handle broadly encoding and it's very efficient. It's not in the standard library, or at least it wasn't the last time I looked. And the first thing it did was it included a third-party package that Andy had written that has a broadly encoder in it. And so Sketch Go gets that in the background in a little container as you're working and has a little Go mod there that modifies. So that as you're editing the code, you get all the code completions from that module, just like you would in a programming environment. And more importantly, we can take that information and feed it into the model as it's working. You know, if we run the Go build system as part of it, and if a build error appears, we can take the build error, feed it into the model. It's like, here's the error, and we can let it ask questions about the third-party package it included, which helps with sort of some of the classic problems you see when you ask Claude to write you some Go code, where it includes a package and then makes up a method in there that doesn't exist that you really mm-hmm. wish existed because it would solve your problem. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of automated tool feedback is doing a lot of the work I have to do manually when I use a frontier model. And so I'm trying to cut out some of those intermediate steps where I said, that doesn't exist. Could you do it this way? Anything like that you can automate saves me time. It means I have to chat less. And so that's the goal, is to slightly climb the complexity ladder in the piece of software we get out of a frontier model and to chat less in the process.
Are you achieving that by having a system prompt, or are you actually fine-tuning? Like, how are you as the sketch.dev creators taking a foundation model and doing something to get here?
Today, it is almost entirely prompt-driven. There's actually more than one model in use under the hood as we try different things. For example, we use a different model for solving the problem of if we want to go get a package, what module do we get to do that? Which sounds like a mechanical process, but it actually isn't. There's a couple of steps there. So a model helps out with that. There's very different sorts of prompts you use for trying to come up with the name of a sketch than there are for answering questions. But at the moment, it's entirely prompt-driven in the sense that a large context window and a lot of careful context construction can handle this, can improve things. And that can include a lot of tool use. Tool use is a very fun feature of models where you can instruct. So to back up and give you a sense of how the models work, an LLM generates the next token based on all the tokens that come before it. When you're in chat mode and you're chatting with a model, you can at any point stop and have the model generate the next token. It could be part of the thing you're asking it or its response. That meta information about who is talking is sort of built into just a stream of tokens. So similarly, you can define a tool that a model can call. You can say, here's a function that you can call and it will have a result. And the model can output the specialized token that says call this function, give it a name, write some parameters. And then instead of the model generating the next token, you pause the stream. You, the caller, go and run some code. You go and run that function call that it defined. Paste the result of that function call in as the next set of tokens, and then ask the model to generate the token after it. So that technique is a great way to have automated feedback into the model. So a classic example is a weather function. And so you define a function which says current weather. The model, then you can ask the model, hey, what's the weather? And the model can say, call function current weather. Your software that's printing out the tokens pauses, calls current weather, says sunny. You paste sunny in there, and then the model generates the next set of tokens, which is the chat response saying, oh, it's currently sunny. And that's the sort of easy way to plug external systems into a model. This is going on under the hood of the user interfaces you use onto frontier models. So this is happening in ChatGPT and Claude and all these systems. Sometimes they show it to you happening, which is how you know. It's you see it less now, but about 6 months ago, you could see in the GPT-4 model, you would ask it questions and it would generate Python programs and run them and then use the output of the Python program in its answer. I had a really fun one where I asked it, how many transistors fit on the head of a pin? And it started producing an answer and it said like, well, transistors are about this big, pins are about this big. And so I guess the magic little emoji appeared that this means this many transistors fit on the head of a pin, some very large number. And if you click on the emoji, it shows you the Python program it generated to do the arithmetic. It executed that as a function call, came back with the result. And that saved it the trouble of trying to do the arithmetic itself, which LLMs are notoriously struggle with doing arithmetic. So it's a great thing to outsource to a program.
And so it's a funny workaround because, you know, if you're a calculator for words, you're not necessarily a calculator for numbers.
Yeah,
and they're much better. If you can't do those reliably, then you could just write a program that does it and returns the same thing every time.
Yes, they're very good at writing programs to do the arithmetic and very bad at doing the arithmetic. So it's a great compromise. The thing we do with Sketch is try to give the underlying model access to information about the environment it's writing code in using function calls. So a lot of our work is not fine-tuning the model. It's about letting it ask questions about not just the standard library, but the other libraries it's trying to use so that it can get better answers. It can look up the Go doc for a method if it thinks it wants to call it. Use that as part of its decision-making process about the code it generates.
Can you describe let it ask? I mean, you've said it a couple of times, and I've been curious about this. When you say let it ask, what does that mean? Like decompress that compressed definition.
So at the beginning in your system prompt or something like your system prompt, depends on the API on exactly how the model works, you say there is a function call, which is get method docs. And it has a parameter, which is name of method. And in the middle of, and then you can ask you can construct a question to an LLM that says, generate a program that does this with the system prompt, which explains that there's a tool call there. And so as your LLM is generating that program, it can pause, make a system call, make a function, a tool call that says, get me the docs for this. And so the LLM decides that it wants to know something about that method call. And then you go and run a program which gets the result, gets the documentation for that method from the actual source of truth. You paste it into the prompt, and then the LLM continues writing the program using that documentation as now part of its prompt. And so this is the model driving the questions about what it wants to know about.
And it just blocks and waits for that to come back.
Yes.
Effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like an embed.
If you step back to like running Llama CPP yourself or something like this, you can sort of oversimplify one of these models as every time you want to generate a token, you hand the entire history of the conversation you've had or whatever the text is before it to the GPU to build the state of the model, and then it generates the next token. It actually generates a probability value for every token in its token set. And then the CPU picks the next token, attaches it to the full set of tokens, and then does that whole process again of sending over the entire conversation and then generating the next token. And so if you think about that sort of that very long, big giant for loop around the outside of every time there's a new token, the token is chosen from the set of probabilities that comes back, is added to the set, and then a new set of probabilities is generated for the next token. You can imagine in the middle of that for loop having some very traditional code in there that inserts a stack of tokens that wasn't actually decided by the LLM, but then become part of the history that the LLM is generating the next token from. And so that's how those embeds work. You can effectively have the LLM communicate with the outside world in the middle there by it driving that, or you don't even have to have it drive it. You could have software outside the LLM that looks at the token set as it's appeared and then insert more tokens for it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all the fun stuff you can do by running these models yourself. Yeah, I know. It's so fun.
Well, friends, I'm here with Samar Abbas, co-founder and CEO of Temporal. Temporal is the platform developers use to build invincible applications. But what exactly is Temporal? Samar, how do you describe what Temporal does?
I would say to explain Temporal is one of the hardest challenges of my life. It's a developer platform, And it's a paradigm shift. I've been doing this technology for almost like 15 years. The way I typically describe it, imagine like all of us when we were writing documents in the 90s, I used to use Microsoft Word. I love the entire experience and everything, but still the thing that I hated the most is how many documents or how many edits I have lost because I forgot to save or like something bad happened and I lost my document. You get in the habit when you are writing up a document back in the 90s to do Control S. Literally every sentence you write. But in the 2000s, Google Doc doesn't even have a save button. So I believe software developers are still living in the 90s era, where majority of the code they are writing is they have some state which needs to live beyond multiple request response. Majority of the development is load that state, apply an event, and then take some actions and store it back. 80% of the software development is this constant load and save. So that's exactly what Temporal does. What it gives you a platform where you write a function, and during the execution of a function, a failure happens, we will resurrect that function on a different host and continue executing where you left off without you as a developer writing a single line of code for it.
Okay, if you're ready to leave the 90s and build like it's 2025, and you're ready to learn why companies like Netflix, DoorDash, and Stripe trust Temporal as their secure, scalable way to build invincible applications, go to temporal.io. Once again, temporal.io. You can try their cloud for free or get started with open source. It all starts at temporal.io.
Is Go particularly well suited for this kind of tooling because of the nature of the language, or is it just your favorite? Or
why? Yeah, that's a really good question. The best programming language for LLMs today is Python. And I believe that is a historical artifact of the fact that all of the researchers working on generative models work in Python. And so they spend the most time testing it with Python and judging a model's results by Python output. There was a great example of this in one of the open benchmarks I looked at, and I believe this has all been corrected since then. This is all about a year old. There was a multi-language benchmark that tested how good a model is across multiple languages. And I opened up the source set for it and looked at some of the Go code, because I'm a Go programmer. And it had been machine translated from Python so that all of the variable names in this Go code used underscores instead of camel case. And you know, the models were getting a certain percentage success rate generating these results. So Josh went through actually and made these more idiomatic in the Go style of using camel case and, you know, putting everything in the right place. And the model gave much better results on this benchmark. And so that's an example of where languages beyond the basic ones that the developers of the models care about are not being paid as much attention to as what you would like. And things are getting a lot better there, you know, as these, you know, the models are much more sophisticated. The teams building them are much larger. They care about a larger set of languages. And so I don't think it's all as Python-centric as it used to be, but that is still very much the first and most important of the languages. As for how well Go works, it seems to work pretty well. Models are good at it by our benchmarks. Like we said, if we took the benchmarks and made them more Go-like, the models actually got better results. They have a real tendency to understand the language. We think it's a pretty good fit. You know, there are definitely times when models struggle, but it's a garbage collected language, which helps. Because in just the same way that garbage collection reduces the cognitive load for programmers as they're writing programs, it reduces the load on the LLM in just the same way. They don't have to track the state of memory and when to free it. And so they have a bit more thinking time to worry about solving your problem. So in that way, it's a good language. It's not too syntax heavy, but it's also, it doesn't have ambiguities that humans struggle with. Right. Yeah, it seems to work
pretty
well.
Small.
Yeah. There aren't a lot of, I haven't seen much research into what is the best language for an LLM. It does seem like an eminently testable thing. Like there's some interesting, in fact, it may end up influencing programming language design in a sense of, imagine you are building a new programming language and you develop a training set that's automatically generated based on you know, translating some existing programs into your language, and you train models for it, you could imagine tweaking the syntax of your new language, regenerating the training set, and then seeing if your benchmarks improve or not. So you could imagine, yeah, you could imagine driving readability of programming languages based on your ability to train an LLM to write this language. And so, yeah, there's lots of really fun things that will happen long term that, you know, I don't think anyone started on work like that yet.
Right. So the level that you all are working at with Sketch, with Go in particular, is the prompting you're doing and the contexting and everything else that you're building, is it at a layer of abstraction where you could replace Go relatively easily with insert general programming language? Or is it like, well, that would be a new product that we would build? Like, how hard is that?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's all of the techniques we're applying are general, but they are all very... each technique requires a lot of Go specific implementation. So in much the same way that like a lot of the techniques inside a language server for a programming language, these are the systems inside VS Code for generating information about programming languages. Mm-hmm. Those are the techniques are general for like what methods are available on this object are this very similar in Go as they would be in Java, for example. Mm-hmm. But the specifics of implementing them for both languages are radically different. And I think it's a lot like that for Sketch. The tricks we're using for Sketch are very Go specific. And if we wanted to build one for Ruby, we would have to build something very, very different.
Okay.
So yes, I consider it very much a Go product right now. And I really like that focus that that gives us.
Sure.
Because Go is a big enough problem on its own, let alone all of programming.
Yeah. I'm just asking that because I wonder how valuable and important tooling like this would be for each language community to either provide or fund or hope that somebody builds, because if the LLM related tooling for Go, because of Sketch, just hypothetically becomes orders of magnitude more useful than just talking to ChatGPT about my Elixir code, for instance, well, that's a real advantage for Go and the Go community. I mean, it's great for productivity for Gophers. And going back to maybe the original question about, you know, should Tailscale have its own little chat bot built into it? Like, does each community need to take up this mantle and say, we need better tooling? Or is it like VS Code should just do it for everybody?
I mean, that's a really good question.
Good job, Dave.
Yeah. So to you know, I very much admire VS Code. I use it. Which, you know, I don't actually have to admire a program to use.
That's
it.
That's better than admiring is using, I think.
Yeah, that's right. But actually I do both. Like I both admire it and fair. Use it. It's, but to look at the inside of VS Code, which I've been doing a bunch of recently, VS Code didn't actually solve language servers for all programming languages. They built JavaScript and TypeScript, JSON, and I think they maintained the C# plugin. They started the Go plugin, I think, and then it got taken over by the Go team at Google, who now maintain the Go support in VS Code. I don't think the Microsoft team built the Ruby support in VS Code. I don't know who did the Python implementation, but a lot of the machinery in VS Code is actually community maintained for these various programming languages. And so I'm not sure there is another option than imagining a world where each of these communities supports the tooling in some form. I don't know if each programming language needs to go out and build their own Sketch. Maybe there is some generalizable intermediate layer, some equivalent of a language server that can be written to feed underlying models. Given our, we're just starting to explore this space. Sketch is very new. We basically started it sometime near the end of November. So there's not much to it yet. So far what we've found is it's far more than the sort of language server environment that you get with VS Code. More machinery is needed to really give the LLM all the tooling it needs. The language server is very useful. We actually use the Go language server in Sketch. GoPlease is a big part of our infrastructure. It's really wonderful software. But there's far more to it than that, to the point where we need to maintain an entire Linux VM to support the tooling behind feeding the model. So what each community needs to provide. I think that's the research in progress, is figuring that out.
It's an interesting question and one I think will be open for a while. I do not want to see a world where Python continues to proliferate merely because of its previous position. I do see with tooling like Devin and Bolt and V0, these are very front-end JavaScript-y companies that are producing these things, which is fine. But it's like, if you are just going to go use that, it's going to produce for you a React and Next.js front-end with a Prisma-based backend. Like, it's all very much like, these are the tools it does. And that's all well and good, but that's going to proliferate more and more of that one thing, where I'd love to see a diversity where it's like, yeah, is there a specific thing for Rails people? Is there one for people who like Zig? Now I'm moving outside of the world of web development, but you know what I'm saying? Like, and I think your answer might be right, which is like, well, every community is going to have to provide some sort of like greasing of the skids for whatever editor is popular or used in order to make their tooling, you know, work well inside of these LLM based helpers, beyond just being like ChatGPT knows about you, which is kind of like the what people are at right now, is like, does ChatGPT know about me? It's the new, am I Googleable, right? It's the new SEO at this point.
I've heard people talk about that. A startup founder, who I won't name, mentioned that they were busy retooling their product so that the foundation models under things like V0 and Bolt would be more likely to NPM include their package to solve a problem.
That's super smart to do that right now.
I agree.
Did they divulge any of the how? Like, what are the mechanical steps that you do that?
I was actually really happy that they said that their plan was to make it really easy to NPM a package and not require a separate sign-up flow to actually get started.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful. Like, their solution to make their product more ChatGPT-able, I guess you might say, is just make their product better, which, you know, if that's...
How avant-garde of them.
Yeah. I'm sure one day we'll end up in the search engine optimization world of frontier models, but today... There's
definitely going to be some black magic for sale. You know, here's how you really do it.
Yeah. I don't see why a frontier model couldn't run an ad auction for deciding what fine-tuning set to bring in. Again, to talk about experiences, I was using one of the voice models and talking to it as I was walking down the street, and I asked it some question about WD-40 because I had a squeaky door. And I think I described in my question WD-40 as a lubricant. And it turns out I just didn't understand that it's not a lubricant, it's a solvent. And the purpose of it is to remove grease.
It took me years to realize that. I think someone finally told me, because I've been using it as a lube all these years.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Why do you got to keep reapplying it? You know, it's not a very good lube.
I just had your experience, but it was an LLM that told me.
Hilarious.
And it mentioned in passing, it's like, yeah, you could also, you know, you could use WD-40 and then use a lubricant like, and then it listed some brand name. And the moment I heard the brand name, I was like, oh, I see. A frontier model could run an ad auction on fine-tuning which brand name to inject there. And that would be a
100%.
It wouldn't require doing it into the pre-training months ahead of time. You could do that sort of on a hour-by-hour basis. So that world is coming. And then once there's a world of ads, there's a world of SEO and all the rest of it.
Well, the more paramount they become, and Adam, you can probably speak to this because you're injecting it into every aspect of your life. Like, if the answer includes a product right there, like, you're just going to be like, all right, I got to get that. Sometimes you don't even realize Kleenex is a product. You know, you think that that's a category, but no, that's a product.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard to tell, honestly.
Kleenex is an easy one for me because we don't have Kleenex in Australia where I'm from. So I came here, right. Everyone started calling tissues Kleenex, and it was a bit of a surprise to me.
It's like Coke or Coca-Cola, something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. I don't know if I've gotten some hallucinations, let's just say, on products.
Mm-hmm.
And even limited information of what's the true good option when it comes to product search. I haven't done a ton of it, mainly on like the motherboard search. Like, I want to do something that has the option for either an AMD Ryzen or Threadripper with, you know, more of a workstation enterprise class CPU, and I want to like maximize some PCIe lanes. So I'm just trying to like figure out what's out there. I'd prefer the chat interface to find things versus the Google interface, which is search by nature to find things. But thus far, it hasn't been super fruitful. I think eventually it'd be cool, but it's not there yet.
I imagine in the YouTube video of this, a little Intel Xeon banner will appear just as you say.
That's right. Yeah, on the ad.
So yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm a fan of Intel Xeons too. I got the I got the Intel Xeon 4210.
Well, now it's really popping up.
There you go. Bing, bing, bing. It's like in Silicon Valley when Dinesh was talking out loud and they had the, I think they had AI in the VR and the, it was, yeah, it was doing some cool stuff. It was pulling up ads real time. It's cool. Nice. It was cool. But yeah, Intel's cool. AMD is cool. But PCIe lanes are even cooler, you know? Give me the max, buy 16, you know?
David, maybe we close with this for those who aren't gophers out there, of course, brand new, you know, hot off the press, still in development, 3 months old, sketch.dev, check it out if you're into Go and those kind of things. But let's imagine you're just a Ruby programmer out there and you came across your blog post about what you've been doing, these three methods of working with AIs. You have autocomplete, you've got chat, you've got search. Where should folks get started if they haven't yet? First of all, is today the day? Like, is it worth it now? Or should I wait? And then secondly, if I am going to dive in and I just want to use it in my local environment to like just code better today, what would you suggest?
Yeah, good question, especially for non-gophers. I would suggest trying out the code completion engines because they take a little bit of getting used to, but not a lot. And depending, if you're writing the sorts of programs they're good at, they're extremely helpful. They save a lot of typing. And it turns out, I was surprised to learn this, but what I learned from code completion engines is a lot of my programming is fundamentally typing limited. It's only so much my hands can do every day. So they're extremely helpful there. The state of code completion engines is they're pretty good at all languages, with a caveat that they're probably not very good at COBOL or Fortran, but all the sort of general languages, like especially like Ruby, I'd expect them to be decent at. I suspect the world of code completion engines will get better at specific languages as people go deeper on the technology. It's a thing I continue to work on, and so I feel confident that it can be improved. The other place that I think most programmers could get value today, if they're not a Go programmer, is writing small isolated pieces of code in a chat interface. So you could try out a ChatGPT or a Claude, or if you really want to have some fun, run a local model and ask it to solve problems. Like try Llama CPP, try Olama, try these various local products, grab one of the really fun models. It's especially easy to try on a Mac with their unified memory. If you're on a PC, you might have to find a model that fits in your GPU, but it's a ton of fun, and use it to say like, write me a Ruby function that takes these parameters and produces this result. And I suspect the model will give you a pretty good result. So those are the places I would start because those require the least amount of learning how to hold the model correctly, and you'll get the most benefit quickly.
Love it. Good answer. I'm just wondering out loud, and feel free not to know, but when it comes to prompting, I know we're past the age of magical incantations, but as you guys have been building out a product, which is basically sophisticated prompting, are there guides that are useful, or are there like, I remember finding a site, I can't remember right now, there's like people are just sharing their system prompts for certain things they do. Like maybe there's like a Ruby prompting guide, which makes it a little bit easier to get quality results out faster. Does either of you guys know?
Yeah, I've seen people write guides like that. I would say the guides I've read are now out of date. We were saying earlier, they guides go out of date. The thing I find most useful is to think of the model I'm talking to as someone who just joined the company. Sometimes I think of them as an intern, though. Every now and again, the models produce much better code than I can. But, interns have done that too. That happens. So, and then as you're writing the question for it, imagine it as like, here's a, you know, I'm talking to a smart person who knows nothing about what I'm doing and they need some background. And that gets me really far with the current frontier models. And so that would be my general piece of advice that I think applies to any programming.
I agree with that too. The random just give me X is you'll get a result, but you'll have to massage it further. You have to, it'll ask you more. I will often give it context. Like you've said, this intern, this smart person that's new to context, they don't have the background awareness that that you want somebody to have. And I'll often like give it a lot of that, have a particular request, but then also say, is there anything else I can give you or any other information you need to give me a successful way? Just some version of like, be successful with our goal. And it's strange even talking like that too, as I even say it out loud, like our goal, as if it's, you know, human. And Jared, you know where we stand on this. But Jared and I have some history, so I've been very kind. Please and thank you.
He's very nice. He talks to him like we're on the same team. And
if
stuff.
If it gives me a great result, I say fantastic. You know, I'm like, you know,
high fives.
Why would I? Yeah, high fives. Why would I be any different?
You offer it money.
No, you know, I haven't done that yet. I gotta try that. I gotta try that. Honestly, but I will ask it. Like, could you be more successful? Is there anything else I can give you? Any more information I can give you to get us to our goal? You know. And I found that that's it. Like, it's context. It's a full circumference of the problem set as much as you can that makes sense. And then you will have a more fruitful interaction. I will also say that I'm more exclusively using ChatGPT. And so the O1 model, while it's expensive, let's just say I don't have the expensive plan. I still don't feel like I can be the person that spends $200 a month on this thing. I would much rather buy a GPU than spend $200 a month. Somehow that math makes more sense to me. But then like O1's been pretty successful with thinking and iterating and, you know, being more precision, whereas 4.0 was a bit more brute, but that's just my personal take.
I think you might be onto something with being nice to models. I caught myself being pretty curt with models a few months back. You know, discussing this a lot with Josh, he mentioned, you know, the conclusion we came to was, you know, one of the challenges of not being nice to models is it sort of trains you to not be nice to people.
Yeah.
Because you're using all of the same tools. And so it might just be good for you to be nice to models.
If it's humanistic, even, you know, similar to a human, why not just be kind? You know, why not?
I hate to break it to you, Adam, but this is not similar to a human.
It's the iteration is, it is, it certainly is. If I were collaborating, if that was a human over there giving me the answers back, it would be very human volleyball iterative.
If
it was.
Right.
I get that it's not, but I'm also like David, why not?
I think I'm somewhere between your two positions because I do think it's just a machine and it's just a tool.
I don't think it's human. Yeah. Don't let me think that.
Yeah. Well, you kind of just said that you think it is.
Did I? I mean, is that how you interpreted it? I just meant that if it, maybe what I mean by that, it's just to be more clear, is kind of keying off what David said, which is like being kind. Just why not? I don't know. I'm like overly like, thank you so much. You're amazing.
It takes time.
I think it's just, I'm a kind person.
Were you nice to Google when it got you a result in the search engine? Like you just,
well, this, your life. It is not a prompt where there's an ebb and a flow or a back and a forth. You know, it's just simply return an answer.
Yeah.
Well, how are we doing? You know, ask you at the end, how are we doing?
You know, I'm not, that being said, I'm not like, thank you very much. I'm just
antagonizing him at this point.
Yeah, I know you are. You're really digging into me, but I can catch myself saying like, that's awesome or great job. Or yeah, I agree with that. Things, isms like that, like you would say to another person.
If that makes you feel more like a nice human, then you should just keep on doing that. But I don't think it's doing anything for the computer.
I don't think it is either.
It is actually costing resources from the world.
Listen to you.
I mean, I think that's you're right. True, it doesn't help the computer. That's I say true please too. And thank you to the models now so that I remember to say please and thank you to humans. That's it. It's purely, you know, I don't want to get into the habit
you're training yourself.
Exactly. It's all about training.
That's fair.
Self-training. That's fair. Yeah, I don't feel like I have to. I feel like it's just a natural atomism. how I do things, how I operate.
Be yourself.
It's who I am in my core. I'm a kind person.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thanks for
sharing all your knowledge. You've learned a lot, and I've learned a lot from you, so we appreciate your time.
This was a ton of fun. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so hopefully hearing David's experience has helped you on your programming with LLM's journey. I'm sure you have thoughts on the matter. Let us hear them in the comments. Yes, there is a Zulip topic dedicated to this episode, and I'm sure there's lots of insightful things being posted by Changelog community members right after they listen. There's a link in your show notes so you can see what's up and join for $0 at changelog.com/community. Let's give one more shout out to our sponsors of this awesome conversation. Thank you to fly.io, to Retool, retool.com/changelog, to Temporal, find them at temporal.io, and to Augment Code. Head to augmentcode.com to get started. And thanks, of course, to our beat freak in residence, the one, the only, Breakmaster Cylinder.
Woo! Yeah, I like beats.
Oh, and we have a little bonus for our favorite kind of listener. That's a Changelog Plus listener, of course. Stay tuned, friends. We go even one layer deeper on what a potential Tailscale AI might look like. If you aren't a Plus member, head to changelog.com/plus today. Right now, even. You're free right now, aren't you? Okay, that's it. This one's done, but we'll talk to you again on Changelogging, friends, on Friday. Bye, y'all.